Hello, good morning, and welcome to Line One, your health connection. I'm your host, Dr. Justin Clark. Today on Line One, we will be discussing a very common topic, especially every spring and summer: allergies. As anyone in Alaska knows, the pollen counts are very high right now, and many people are noticing their cars covered with pollen and symptoms of coughing, sneezing, and watering eyes. What is the best way to deal with seasonal allergies? And what about other types of allergies, like pet allergies or food allergies in children and adults? How do we test for these? And can they be treated, or can people even be desensitized to these allergies? Other forms of allergies include eczema, urticaria, contact dermatitis, and allergic rhinitis. How are these diagnosed, and how do we know when to see a doctor? Finally, if we have time, asthma is an extremely common condition and has many forms and levels of severity. Today, I am very pleased to be joined by Dr. Laura Moore and PA Brian Farthing from Allergy, Asthma, and Immunology Center of Alaska. You can be a part of our conversation. If you have a question or a comment, please give us a call, toll-free, statewide, 1-888-353-5752. 1-888-353-5752. In Anchorage, 907-550-8433. 907-550-8433. Or you can email us at line1, that's spelled out, at alaskapublic.org. Dr. Moore, it's a pleasure to have you on the show today. Thank you for being with us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
I would like to give you an opportunity here to introduce yourself to our listeners and tell us a little bit about yourself and how you got to Alaska and a little bit why, how you got into allergy medicine and why you like it.
Sure, absolutely. My name is Dr. Laura Moore, as you mentioned. I am married to a retired Air Force nurse, and I have four children. One in college, one heading off to college, and then one in high school and one just entering middle school. I actually am an Air Force brat. I was born in Montana. My dad joined during Vietnam, so we traveled around a little bit for his career, but our family is from Montana, so we eventually made our way back there. I did join the Air Force to pay for medical school. So I did my medical school and my residency and my allergy training through the Air Force. My husband and I were joint spouse. We ended up in Phoenix, Arizona as our last station together, where our last two children were also born. He retired from Phoenix, and then I transferred to the reserve. So then I was a reservist for 13 years and retired in 2016 from the Air Force. I actually came to Alaska to join this clinic that I am in right now. Providers that were previously here were allergists that I trained with in Biloxi, Mississippi in the Air Force 20 years ago. So it's a small world, and we ended up on the opposite side of the country together, working in private practice together. I love Alaska. It's very much like my home state of Montana. Love the outdoors and what Alaska has to offer. I got into allergy because I'm an allergy sufferer myself. I've actually done allergy shots a number of times throughout my life. And it's just obviously something that I'm familiar with. Yeah. That's a little bit about me.
Well, thank you. It's great. Thank you for your service. I too was served here at J-Bear in the Air Force, and they helped me through medical school, and that's kind of how I got to Alaska too. So I understand a little bit about your service there. PA Brian Farthing, thanks for joining us on the show. I want to give you the same opportunity, please, if you could introduce yourself to our listeners.
My story is very similar to Dr. Moore's, as I was also an Air Force brat and joined the Air Force myself as a respiratory therapist. And the Air Force sent me to Alaska, and then I fell in love with the state, got married, have a couple kids myself. Me and my wife actually still currently serve in the Alaska Air National Guard, where we're proud to be local members. I was recruited to this practice about 10 years ago after PA school, and then subsequently went on to finish my training in healthcare administration, and I finished up my doctorate at Nova Southeastern with a focus in pediatric asthma disparities. So Dr. Moore is obviously the owner and medical director of our practice, and I work in the capacity of the clinical services director and oversee our pollen specifically here at the practice, which is probably my favorite thing that I get to do and be a part of. But I'm also grateful and happy to be able to serve not just our community for Alaska, but in the capacity for treating patients with asthma and allergy, because it's so tangible. So we get to see differences every single day in our patients.
Oh, absolutely. Again, also, thank you for your service. Looks like we're having a little Air Force reunion here, so it's great. Well, let's jump into it. Let's get into the seasonal allergies, and I'll start with you, Dr. Moore. I guess the first easiest question I can think of is how common are seasonal allergies?
Seasonal allergies affect almost every spectrum of the lifespan. They generally start around the 4 to 5 year old kids and then go up into kind of the 50s and 60s and then taper off. But the incidence is about 10 to 30% in both pediatrics and adults. We actually outgrow allergies as we get older because they're a function of the immune response. So we don't tend to see allergies as much in the elderly. And then in the younger population, we see more perennial allergies. It's the seasonal ones that start once they've been through a couple pollen seasons. But 10 to 30% is the general incidence in the U.S.
Okay, so that's really common. And I guess what are the most common symptoms that someone would come in? Let's say this spring, we got all the pollen, and we can talk a little bit about the pollen and the different types and how those cause allergies. But what are the most common symptoms for people coming in saying, hey, I think I'm having seasonal allergies?
The most common symptoms that we see for allergies are both nasal and ocular. So for the nose, people will get a runny nose. They get a lot of sneezing, itching. The runny nose can also alternate between being really drippy or really stuffy. You get a lot of eye symptoms to include red, watery, itchy, and puffy eyes. And then if allergies are severe enough, sometimes they can also provoke an asthma response. So we'll get people that will also complain of some coughing, chest tightness, or wheezing during the peak of their allergy season.
Great. And you mentioned there's eye symptoms as well.
Yeah. So the red, water, itchy, puffy eyes are all pretty common too.
Okay. So how do you differentiate that from, I guess I'll pose this one to Brian because I want to get you involved here in the conversation too, Brian. Someone's coming in with signs and symptoms or complaints of seasonal allergies, but a lot of those seem to also be like cold related symptoms or just something that's really like the common cold or a virus. How do you guys differentiate between the two?
Yeah, that's a really great question. There's a couple key factors. We regularly say that if there's the magic test to say if this is a cold or allergies, it probably make a lot of money, but there's a few distinguishing factors. One with allergies, you don't spike a fever. So that's a pretty telltale sign if someone's coming in with what seems like a cold or allergy symptoms and they're spiking a fever, it's likely infectious in nature, which is interesting because if you go back over 100 years ago when allergies were first identified and it was they were describing what is hay fever, it's because it seemed like this prolonged illness that was going on, but lacked the fever or the components that would make you think that this is associated with an infectious capacity. And then seasonal trends and the vignette of the patient can also play into roles. And so if it happens the same time every year and or associated when you go into your mother's house who has cats and or animals. So there's some distinguishing factors there that can help identify or make the difference with the patients.
Excellent. Yeah. And Dr. Moore, anything to add to that?
Yes, I think the other thing I would add is itching is a predominant factor of allergies. So we see a lot of mucosal itching in people that have allergies. So the eyes itch, the nose itch, the inside of the ear itches, the back of the throat really deep in there itches. Those are symptoms that you don't tend to see as much with viral infections. It's generally more of an allergy symptom.
Got it. Okay. So that could be a differentiating factor there. Excellent. So what's going on right now in Alaska? So the pollen counts are high, I imagine. When I was looking at your website, I think you guys actually had a link to a pollen counter. Is that right? Was I correct on that?
I will actually have PA Farthing address that. So we do pollen counts in our office, and he runs that program. So I'll let him answer that question.
Great. Brian, tell us about pollen.
This is the exciting stuff here. So hang on. We had the opportunity, I think now with Dr. Mora, about 7 or 8 years ago, we were able to continue to provide this service to the community because it used to be a state-funded program. The state took care of both air quality and pollen counting, and they had full-time staff that were able to do that. We measure the pollen through a machine called a Burkhard trap, and it's done over a 24-hour period. So when the state lost funding about 7 or 8 years ago, we were able to take that over, and then we all have some level of training, either through fellowship and or through different meetings we go to be able to do this. So we now offer it as a something that we think is important to the community, but there's no reimbursement for this. There's no benefit other than making sure that patients have access to this information. So it's generally something we do after hours and or at lunch, and can take anywhere from 30 minutes to a couple hours per day to get that pollen count. Just can give you an idea or a spectrum on what's going on. So we have this Burkhard trap that we have on the top of our roof here at the hospital. It's electronically ran that entrains about 10 liters of air per second. And there's a slide that we keep in there, and it moves approximately 1 millimeter per hour. And we look at that over a 24-hour period, and then we're able to distinguish based on different shapes and sizes and colors of the different pollens that we see that are unique to Alaska. And when we talk about pollen specifically, I think it's important to say that they're both entomophilus-based pollinating plants and anemophilus-based pollinating plants. And this is kind of a key component when you start to think about what may be an allergic pollen or not. So if we just looked at the numbers right now, in fact, yesterday was our first day that we had gone below that 100 grains per cubic meter threshold, which is considered high and can be considered significant for patients who have sensitizations and allergies to the pollens that are in our environment. They started seeing pollen as early as April this year, so April 25th. And then as of yesterday, our pollen count was around 84 grains per cubic meter. So if you just kind of think about a cubic meter of air, that's about the average of grains per cubic meter that you're seeing. And then we distinguish them by species. So we have trees and weeds and grasses, and we have historical data on what's coming out at this time. Right now in the air, there is birch, there's alder, there's also a lot of spruce, which I think is one of the more interesting ones to talk about, is that when we generally think about entomophilus and anemophilus pollinating plants, entomophily being a pollen that needs to be transmitted by an insect like a bee because it's large. And it's large, and when pollens are large, they're generally not allergic because they're too large to get past the nose hairs and get into the immune system and be identified by that part of the immune system that causes allergy. Whereas anemophilus-based pollinating plants like birch trees and alder trees, those pollens are most of the time allergenic because of the size, but it also makes them the perfect size to get up into the wind and travel hundreds of miles per day. So if I go back to our pollen count right now and look at the things that are high, it's all anemophily based plants that we're catching. The caveat to all of this is spruce is an anemophilous pollinating tree, but is not considered to be allergenic because of the size. It's about 100 microns in size. So this yellow hue of pollen that we're seeing right now is mostly spruce and is mostly not allergenic, but it can be an irritant. So I think that's kind of a good overview of what we're seeing in the air right now.
Dr. Yeah, Moore? I notice it when I come out in the morning and my car is covered in yellow pollen and having to get a car wash all the time. So that's mostly spruce pollen. And what you're saying is it's not incredibly allergenic because it's maybe too big to get into the lungs. And so a lot of what people are experiencing symptoms for are the smaller particles that we're not seeing. Is that correct?
That is correct. It's the tiny 10 to 25 micron pollens that are the ones that get into our eyes and nose and airways and contribute to symptoms. When you look at the any of the pine pollen family under the microscope, they're massive. They almost take up the entire slide. They're just a really large pollen. So they're not generally considered to be allergenic. We see them. I mean, you visibly see them, and that's what's coating everything. And obviously, when you have symptoms and you visibly see a pollen, people will associate it with the visible pollen that you can see, but it's generally the invisible one that's causing the issues. We see that a lot also when the cottonwood starts to fly. So cottonwood generally will start flying in June, and people blame the cottonwood for that seasonal allergy, but June is actually when the grass pollinates. The cottonwood is generally done pollinating at that point. So that's another confusing one where people visibly see the cottonwood floating through the air and blame that on the symptoms they're getting when it's the invisible grass pollen they can't see. That's probably more the issue.
Oh, it's interesting. I had no idea. I would have, I always, exactly what you said, attribute what I'm seeing to what I'm feeling. I want to give our listeners a real quick reminder if they want to call with a question, 888-353-5752. In Anchorage, 907-550-8433. Or email me at line1@alaskapublic.org. I guess the next question would be, how the heck do we prevent these, Dr. Moore? I guess we could divide it up into prevention, if there is a way, or treatment. And we can go into these individually. But is there a way to prevent these?
As far as preventing allergic rhinitis, is that your question?
Well, I guess, is there any preventative treatment to sort of prevent someone from reacting or becoming or experiencing allergies from the alder or birch or these small ones, rather than symptomatically treating it after it happens?
Yeah, okay. So I'll actually kind of answer your question from both perspectives then. So allergic rhinitis is genetically co-inherited with three other conditions. So asthma, allergic rhinitis, eczema, and food allergies are all inherited together. So if you have first-degree relatives that have any of those conditions, then depending on the number of first-degree relatives that have those conditions, your odds increase with an increasing number of first-degree relatives. So, for example, if a child is born and one parent has a history of eczema when they were younger, that genetics is still there. So the child with one first-degree relative has about a 33% chance of having any of those four conditions. If both parents or a parent and a sibling had any of those four conditions, then the next child's risk actually goes up to about 67%. So their odds are high in people that have allergic families of developing one of those conditions. Now, your parent could have allergic rhinitis and their kiddos could have eczema or asthma, so it's not a one-to-one correlation with what they inherit. But once they develop those allergies, which, like I said, generally will start in the younger population with year-round allergies, the thought is if early in life, if you expose kids to more toxins and bacterial that have toxins on them, or endotoxins is what they refer to them as, then the incidence of allergies actually potentially can be decreased. So the biggest example of that is maybe having more pets in the home during the first year or two of life. They've actually shown even better improvement if your kids are exposed to wildlife, or not really wildlife, but maybe more farm animals, just because they have more toxin exposure. And then maybe not being so sterile and clean, so not having as many antibacterial hand soaps and antibacterial this and antibacterial that, because it skews how the immune system responds. But once a person develops allergies and they're going into a pollen season that is their peak season, there are some things you can do to prevent symptoms or to decrease symptoms without taking medications. We are unfortunate in Alaska in that most of the homes here don't have have air conditioning. But in homes that have air conditioning, that's one thing to do is just to stay inside and not go outside when the pollens are out on windy days or on days where the pollen counts are higher. Just stay inside where it's cool with the windows closed. In Alaska, because we don't have that opportunity, we still do recommend that people don't go out during the peak pollen times, which are in the early hours of the morning. And then also, on days where it's really windy, not to spend a lot of time outdoors because the pollens are obviously blowing around a lot more during those times.
Very interesting stuff. So the pollen is more prevalent in the morning, more common on windier days, obviously, because it's getting blown off the trees and spread around. And we can potentially reduce the lifelong allergy suffering if kids are exposed a little bit more at an earlier age. Is that right?
There's a hypothesis that our immune system either skews towards having an allergic pathway or not an allergic pathway early on in life, and that process can be maybe pushed one direction or another based off of early life exposures. So there's lots of research that's been done in this area, because obviously if we can decrease the burden of allergic disease in the population, then that has lots of long-term benefits, both financially and health-wise, for our communities. But yeah, the thought is that, you know, two or more animals in the house, having those farm animal exposures, maybe not being so sterile in the environment as far as sanitizing everything, can be helpful.
Okay, yeah, that's what I told my kids growing up, is like a little dirt's not going to hurt you. It, you know,
that's actually true. Good for you.
It's good for you. It's good for you. Yeah. Okay, I want to take a quick break. You are listening to Line One, Your Health Connection. If you have a question or a comment for our guest today, give us a call statewide, 1-888-353-5752, 1-888-353-5752, or in Anchorage at 907-550-8433, 907-550-8433. After this short break, we'll continue our discussion on allergies and asthma with Dr. Laura Moore and PA Brian Farthing.
You're listening to Line One from Alaska Public Media. You can find Line One on alaskapublic.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
Whether this is your first try to quit or you've been down this path before, Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line can help you quit for good. Get help creating a plan that is right for you, no matter if you smoke cigarettes, vape, use smokeless tobacco, or ICMIC. With options like calling a coach, receiving text messages, and nicotine replacement therapy with patches or gum, you can quit your way at any time of day or night. Call Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line at 1-800-QUIT-NOW or visit alaskaquitline.com. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line.
Welcome back to Line One, Your Health Connection. I'm your host, Dr. Justin Clark. I'm joined today by Dr. Laura Moore and PA Brian Farthing from the Allergy, Asthma, and Immunology Center of Alaska. If you have a question or a comment, call us toll-free statewide at 1-888-353-5752, 1-888-353-5752. In Anchorage, 907-550-8433, 907-550-8433, or email us at line1@alaskapublic.org. Dr. Moore, we have a couple calls, emails coming in. I want to ask you, so I want to start talking about particularly pets, because I'm getting some calls or some emails about that. Also about immunotherapy. So do you think, is immunotherapy more related to seasonal allergies, or should we get through the pets first and then talk about immunotherapy? Where does immunotherapy fit in?
Immunotherapy is used to address any airborne allergen. So it helps with dust mites in animals and allergies, the pollen allergies as well. So it's a good treatment option for all of them.
Perfect. So let's go into like animal and pet allergies a little bit. And then when we talk about treatment, we can get into the immunotherapy question, because that's a common one here. But first, let me go ahead and let's take line two, please. We'll take our first caller. Craig is calling from Fairbanks. Craig, welcome to line one.
Thank you. I used to get birch allergies. I think that's what it was, really bad, and affected my lungs and my eyes and everything. And what I've done is I tap my birch trees, and I drink a lot of birch water. I make soup out of it. I make it in smoothies. I cook my rice in it. And I froze a bunch of bottles, kind of reduced, that I take on and off. And then also I made the syrup. What do you know about birch water for allergies?
That's good. Craig, before you sign off there, did it have you... noticed any difference in your allergies with doing all of that?
Oh, it's cleared up except for I get eye irritation, but I think the pollen gets in my eyes and the birch water doesn't totally cure that. But my lungs and everything, they haven't been bothering me at all the last couple of years.
All right. Thanks for your call, Craig. I'll pose your question here to our guests. I really appreciate it. Let's see. Either Dr. Moore or PA Farthing, happy to answer Craig's question here.
Thank you, Craig, for your question. I haven't seen any specific literature regarding birch water, but my thought is that when you're tapping the tree, when you're doing anything involving the tree itself, you're probably incorporating some of the birch pollen into the products that you're making, and then you're ingesting that birch pollen. That is a little bit analogous to another therapy that allergists will do called sublingual immunotherapy, which is similar to allergy shots, except it's given under the tongue. The big difference being that when it's done by an allergist, it's a very controlled, consistent dose, whereas if you're doing birch water or birch syrup or any other modality, the amount of pollen may vary from dose to dose, so you're not really sure how much you're getting. So the benefit is, obviously, it's a therapy that we offer in a controlled setting that can certainly help allergies. The only risk of doing it probably at home on your own is because it's not a controlled volume. There is an anaphylaxis risk from ingesting it, which obviously we hope people don't experience that. But that's my thought, is probably you're ingesting some of the pollen and desensitizing through that route.
That's very cool. Very cool. So let's get into animal and pet allergies. So I guess, how common are these and what are the most common pets that are triggering allergies for patients? And we'll start with you, Brian.
Yeah, thank you so much. It's our favorite pets. It's the cat and the dog dander. FLD1. It's a heck of an allergen. It's tenacious. That cat allergen can stick around for many, many, many months. It's interesting is that we get a lot of questions about hypoallergenic dogs and cats, and my dog or my cat will shed less, so I'm less allergic to that breed or so forth. In general, the approach is if you have symptoms and sensitization, so either skin testing and or blood testing, that's how you make a diagnosis of allergen. I think that's important to identify and remember here. So if someone who comes in and says, when I get around a cat, my eyes get itchy and I sneeze, I think I might be allergic to cat. And I say, well, it sounds like you might be allergic to cat. So then we test them with skin testing and or serological testing when indicated. We corroborate that with sensitization. So then you talk about, well, how can you avoid or mitigate the allergies? And just like Dr. Moore mentioned with the pollens is, the first step to controlling your allergy response is to decrease your exposure. So then they say, well, do I need to get rid of my cat and my dog? And we learned very early on that we tell everyone to get rid of their cats and their dogs, they're just going to get rid of us. So we come up with strategies to help minimize the exposure to the allergen component itself, which is the dander and the saliva. I'll just let the cat out of the bag here, and that there is no such thing as hypoallergenic animals, because there's varying degrees of allergenicity within different species, but there's not less dander on different animals. And they've done multiple studies controlling both in tube studies and wipe down studies, et cetera. So the take home is if you have an animal, you want to make sure you wash them regularly to get rid of that dander. If you have symptoms around your animal, decrease exposure to the animal. So specifically like pet-free sleeping areas and in some cases, needing medication and or immunotherapy to help better control the symptoms associated with those animals.
Okay, excellent. Excellent suggestions. And Dr. Moore, anything to add to the common pet allergies?
Yes, I think the only thing I would say is there is one hyperallergenic cat. It's actually the bald sphinx cat. There are no hyperallergenic dogs. They've actually done studies looking at the breeds of dogs that have been advertised as hyperallergenic, and they all make the allergen. So there's just breed-to-breed variation as far as which cat breeds and which dog breeds cat and dog allergic patients will react to. But Brian's right. There generally aren't hyperallergenic animals.
Oh, that's really cool. I once had a poodle, and one of the reasons that we chose that breed was because it's supposed to have hair rather than fur, and less allergy potential. But I guess that was not true.
That you are right. It's actually their dander people react to. It's not the hair.
Okay. Awesome. So, okay. So these are really, really common. We can reduce by, you mentioned pet-free sleeping area. So maybe having or where your bedroom is, you know, where you're sleeping at night, you know, not having the pets in that room, or not having them lick you maybe for the saliva. So there's ways that you can mitigate it without having to get rid of the pet. Is that right, Ryan?
Yeah, and the one thing I'll also mention, that when Dr. Marr was discussing ways to mitigate your pollen allergies, is we regularly forget that our animals go outside and then come back in. So let's just say if you're not dog sensitized, but you're pollen sensitized, and that animal goes outside and then comes back in, and we love on our animals, and the animal will then disperse the pollen in the house, you can get exposure to pollen through your animal as well.
Okay, now that's a good thought. Let me ask you about horses too, because that's a common question. I have daughters, and they like to ride horses. And at one point, we thought that my daughter was developing allergies to horses because she'd feel, you know, kind of sneezy and watery when she was riding them. And so I think we came in and got tested. It was an interesting experience. We were in your guys' office actually, and so walk us through like what you do for testing, because you know, I guess I'm not a layperson, but for someone that's not, you know, up to date on all the allergy stuff, you guys did pricks. I think it was about 50 different exposures to different allergens, and then we kind of waited to see what happened. So, how do you guys test for these? Like, can you explain all that? And Dr. Moore or Brian, either way, Dr. Moore maybe.
Sure, absolutely. So allergen skin testing was studied for many, many years, and they over time have developed extracts, some of which are standardized to a certain content and concentration, and other ones that aren't standardized by the FDA. And they're manufactured by several companies in the United States according to pretty strict standards. So they're sterile, they're consistent from lot to lot, you know, so we know what the allergen content is and the concentration of them are. But the panel that we have in our office is specific to Alaska, and you'll find that anywhere in the United States, and generally probably anywhere in the world, pollen allergens are generally tested based off of the pollens in the community. So obviously we're not testing to things that you're going to maybe see in Arizona as much or on the East Coast as much, with the exception of we do add some of the southern grasses because our patients tend to like to go into Hawaii. And then we also add ragweed, which is a common weed in the lower 48. But these extracts come to us, and we have them in a little tray with wells in them. There's a handful of different devices that are available for testing. The particular one that we use is called a Quintess. It's about maybe 4 or 5 inches long, and it has 5 little shafts that come off of it. And at the base of those shafts are just tiny, minute, microscopic little needles with a cuff around it that prevent it from really puncturing into the skin very far. So those are taken out of the tray, and then we clean the back off. We put numbers on the back so we know where we're putting each of the tests. And then that Quintess is just rocked on the skin. So it's a very superficial prick. It actually shouldn't puncture the surface. It shouldn't bleed. Shouldn't even really cause much of a mark, just a little red spot. And then once those are put on, we do a negative control for comparison. So sometimes people get a hive just from being scratched. So that's what we're looking for. And then we also do a histamine positive control just to make sure people aren't on medications that would potentially make our test negative. And then once they're placed, the allergens generally peak in 15 to 17 minutes. So we'll read them. And then what we're doing is we're measuring the hive that pops up. There's a grading scale, again, based off of a lot of research on what tends to be clinically significant and what isn't clinically significant. So based off of that grading scale, then we can make interpretations as far as what someone is allergic to or not allergic to. If we have a good history, like Brian mentioned, the cats and having sneezing, itchy eyes around cats, if we have a good clinical history of an allergy to a specific either pollen season or to an animal or dust mites, and that is negative on skin testing on the back, then we'll do another layer test called an intradermal test. intradermals are the same style of tests that we use to do PPD or TB testing. But those are done on the forearm. They're a little bit more sensitive. Because they're more sensitive, we don't do the whole panel because we'll get a lot of false positives if we do extensive testing, but we do it really more specific to the allergens that we have in question based off of the history. So those are placed on the forearm and then also read in 15 to 20 minutes. And then if on rare occasion, if we have a patient that really, really, really just still has a compelling history and we can't find it on a prick or an intradermal, then we'll follow that up with a serum blood test. But it's not often that we end up doing that. The prick skin testing is generally considered the gold standard way of looking for allergies.
Yeah, it was pretty interesting from my experience and, you know, seeing kind of the reactions to a bunch of different things. I know you guys tested for like, I don't know, 50 different things. And it was interesting to see like what, and there's different levels of a reaction, you know, depending on the allergen. And as it turned out, she wasn't allergic to horses, which was surprising. But maybe she was allergic to the pollen while riding the horses. Who knows?
The grass is actually common. Grass, dust mites, and mold are common with horses too, just because of the environment they live in.
Cool. So let's.
You hit with the grass. Yeah. The
now, yeah, Brian.
I was just going to say it's, and that's when the clinical experience of the allergy team comes to play, is that we have many years of working through these cases, and if someone comes and says, you know, I'm having symptoms around my horse. Well, we know that, you know, although it could be the horse does have an allergenic component. A lot of times it's not the horse, and like Dr. Morris said, it's the grass and or the mold or the dust mites. And very, very similar to having other animals in the home. You know, we put hay in kennels, or if you have another example of something like that would be if you have a live Christmas tree. We know that, you know, in general, you know, the pine species are not allergenic, but if you have water sitting and you can have mold that can grow and you can have sensitization to the mold. So kind of, you know, thinking through these different clinical situations, when you have symptoms that are consistent with allergy, but then knowing, you know, within that differential, what else could be around that could be causing the symptoms.
Absolutely. That's very interesting. And I think what we'll do here, I want to talk a little bit about, I want to make sure we get a chance to talk about immunotherapy because I have a few emails about that, but also I want to talk about food allergies. Is that something that you guys see in your practice too, Dr. Moore?
Absolutely. Food allergies are a large component of what allergists manage and diagnose and treat. Like I said earlier, they're part of that diathesis of the genetic component of the allergic rhinitis, asthma, eczema, and food allergies. Those often come together, and it's not uncommon, particularly in kids, to see all four of those conditions in one patient.
So having some food allergies can actually be genetic?
Oh, absolutely. As I mentioned earlier, you genetically inherit the potential to have asthma, eczema, allergic rhinitis, and or food allergies based off of what your parents have had or what your siblings have had. So yes, you could have really, really bad hay fever and your child could then end up with food allergies. So it, there's a big genetic component to it.
Okay. What are the most common food allergies that you guys are seeing or testing for? It could be children or adults.
Yeah. In the United States, the most common food allergies in kids tend to be milk, eggs, soy, and wheat, as well as peanut. In adults, those extend to peanut, tree nuts, fish, and shellfish. And then sesame was actually added as the ninth most common allergen recently in the United States as well. So milk, egg, soy, wheat, peanuts, tree nuts, fish, shellfish, and sesame are the top nine in the U.S.
That is amazing. And so, gosh, so, and I mean, I've always heard a lot about peanuts and you see them, but and for a while they were taken off airplanes and things like that, but now they seem to be back. How, like, what is the sensitivity level of people that you're seeing with allergies? I mean, you know, it can range from very, very minor, maybe some GI upset or something like that. And then the severe ones could actually be anaphylactic shock, right?
Absolutely. You know, generally in young kids, like the infants and toddlers, the most common symptom that we see for new onset food allergies is hives, which hives can be disturbing in a young infant, particularly if they get swelling associated with it. But most of the time, those don't tend to be life-threatening symptoms. Certainly with ongoing exposure and with age, those symptoms can be more severe and can be anaphylactic. It's rare to have just GI symptoms as part of a food allergy. Generally, with an allergic response, you'll have two or more organ systems involved. So maybe hives and GI symptoms, or coughing or wheezing with vomiting or diarrhea. There is another entity called oroallergy syndrome. It's a little bit different than a classic food allergy. We see a lot of that here in Alaska because we have really high birch pollen counts, probably higher than most parts of the country. Because of that, I think we tend to see more foods that are associated with the birch pollen. But basically, there are lots of fruits and vegetables, peanuts, several of the tree nuts that cross-react with birch pollen. So when you eat those foods in the fresh form, the body thinks you're eating birch pollen. And if you're allergic to birch, then obviously you're going to get symptoms from the food. Those are generally oral, like mouth itching, tongue itching, throat itching. Sometimes people will get tongue swelling or lip swelling. And then there is a 20% chance of breaking out in hives, or a 10% chance of having that more systemic anaphylactic response. And interestingly, every birch patient has their own list of foods that they react to. So not everyone reacts to every food that potentially cross-reacts with birch. It seems to be patient-specific.
Hmm. Okay. I want to, looks like we have a call from Gail. Gail, welcome to Line 1.
Thanks. I just was going to raise the issue about oral allergy syndrome, but you've just dealt with it.
No,
it's
problem.
Really common in Alaska.
Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you for the call, Gail. Appreciate it. Why don't we go ahead and take our second break? We were listening to Line 1, your health connection. If you have a question or a comment for our guest today, call us statewide, 1-888-353-5752. 1-888-353-5752. Or in Anchorage at 907-550-8433. 907-550-8433. After this short break, we'll continue our discussion on allergies and asthma with Dr. Laura Moore and PA Brian Farthing.
You're listening to Line 1 from Alaska Public Media. You can find Line 1 on alaskapublic.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
Whether this is your first try to quit or you've been down this path before, Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line can help you quit for good. Get help creating a plan that is right for you, no matter if you smoke cigarettes, vape, use smokeless tobacco, or ICMIC. With options like calling a coach, receiving text messages, and nicotine replacement therapy with patches or gum, you can quit your way at any time of day or night. Call Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line at 1-800-QUIT-NOW or visit alaskaquitline.com. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line.
Welcome back to Line 1, your health connection. I'm your host, Dr. Justin Clark. I'm joined today by Dr. Laura Moore and PA Brian Farthing from the Allergy, Asthma, and Immunology Center of Alaska. If you have a question or a comment, call us statewide at 1-888-353-5752, 1-888-353-5752. In Anchorage, 907-550-8433, 907-550-8433, or email us at line1@alaskapublic.org. Dr. Moore, let's talk about immunotherapy. Now, I guess my first question about it is what the heck is it? And what do you use, or what is it used to treat? Is it seasonal allergy type stuff, animals, foods, all of it? Like, let's get into immunotherapy.
Absolutely. Immunotherapy is a desensitization procedure. So basically, we treat both airborne allergies, and I'll talk a little bit more about the oral allergies. So both seasonal, animal dander, dust mite, or any of those airborne allergies can be addressed with immunotherapy. So we use the same extracts that I described for skin testing. We write prescription based off of the skin test result for the patient. Those extracts are then diluted. So when we do immunotherapy, we start at a very dilute concentration, and then we sequentially over time with doses anywhere from once a week twice a week to once every 2 weeks, anywhere in that spectrum, just depending on the patient's availability, work up to what's called a maintenance dose. That maintenance dose has been what's been studied to be shown as the therapeutic effective dose. And then once we hit that therapeutic dose, then we continue that monthly for about 3 to 5 years. So during that time, a patient is desensitized to the allergens. They've actually shown that that process starts pretty quickly after starting allergy shots, and then it continues to improve, and you tend to continue to see benefit every year that you're on them. And then somewhere in that 3 to 5 year course, in that 3 to 5 year mark, you'll see a plateau of benefit. And that's why we generally stop allergy shots after 3 to 5 years.
Okay, so it's a desensitization process. So basically by giving someone low doses of the allergen that they react to, you're using the body's own immunologic systems to create a response or to become, you know, not allergic to it?
That's correct. Yes, we're actually, we're inducing kind of a state of tolerance by doing those continuous frequent low dose exposures. We're obviously doing it in a graded controlled environment. So we know the dose that we're giving every time we administer it, and we're doing it in that controlled setting in a safe place where if there is a response, obviously we can treat it. But yeah, we're using the body's immune system to create tolerance to the allergens. I also mentioned oroallergy syndrome. The oroallergy syndrome, the only treatment is actually avoidance of the food. So if you have oroallergies from apples or cherries or peanuts or whatever, we generally recommend avoidance of the fruits in the fresh form. You can tolerate them cooked, and then the nuts in any form. But allergy shots to the pollen that's causing the oroallergy syndrome oftentimes then gets rid of those oroallergy triggers as well. So that's another way to treat the oroallergy syndrome is through immunotherapy.
Okay. Are there any reactions that people have to even the lower doses, or do people have side effects from these shots during the process?
Absolutely. Actually, P.A. Farthing treats a lot of our shot reactions, so I'll let him take that one.
Yeah, so anything we do in medicine has risk and benefit, which is why, one, not everyone's a candidate for allergy shots. So we have a discussion on patient options, patient selectivity. There's anywhere from a large local reactions when patients are getting allergy shots, as you can imagine when you're getting a sub-Q shot in your arm, to having a full-blown systemic reaction, which is could be severe and can cause anaphylaxis, and anaphylaxis can ultimately end in anaphylactic shock or laryngeal edema. So we observe our patients. We also do things to mitigate the risk associated with this. So as we know, there's certain things that can rev the immune system up and make you more susceptible to having an allergic reaction. Like if you were to exercise and come get your shot, if you're sick and you come get your shot, if you have uncontrolled asthma and you come get your allergy shot, or if you go volunteer at the animal shelter and have a large dose of allergen exposure and then come in and get your shot. Or if you have too much time between your shots and then try to get a certain dose. So there are certain things that can increase the risk. But in general, there's still a certain percentage of patients will go on to have either large local and or systemic. There has been reported fatalities with allergy shots. Those numbers have gone down over the years. The most recent literature supports 1 in 7.2 million injections or one or less per year in the United States. That's the general consensus right now.
That's extremely rare. Extremely rare. Yeah. Wow. So the shots, and then in terms of other treatments for allergies, I mean, I've gone to the store. There is literally, you know, you have an entire wall of options for antihistamines and all of that. Is there stuff that works better than other stuff, or is it really patient dependent? I mean, what's the go-to? Let's start with over-the-counter, and then maybe we can talk about prescriptions as well. Dr. Moore, I'll pose this one to you first.
Sure. So the over-the-counter allergy meds are divided up into a couple of different categories. So first you have the oral antihistamines, both the short-acting and the long-acting. There are a handful of nasal steroids that have gone over the counter. And then more recently, there was a nasal antihistamine that went over the counter. So for the oral antihistamines, we don't generally recommend using short-acting antihistamines to treat allergies. So the one that's over the counter is Benadryl. Benadryl crosses the blood-brain barrier, so it does have cerebral nervous system effects. So sedation being a big one, but there have also been some studies recently that have linked long-term recurring use of it to dementia in the elderly, so another reason not to use it. We recommend the longer-acting antihistamines, so Claritin or loratadine, Zyrtec, which is also called cetirizine, Xyzal, which is levocetirizine, and then Allegra, which is fexofenadine. And of course, a lot of the pharmacies have their own version of them, like Walzer or Allertec, you know, they make different versions of them. These are all daily antihistamines that can actually, even though a lot of them, those are all generally once daily, they can also be used twice a day if needed. Nasal steroids are another class that I mentioned. So the four that are over the counter are the Flonase, Flonase Sensimist, Rhinocort, and Nasacort. And then the antihistamine nasal spray is Astepro, or Azelastin is the generic for it. So when you're looking at treating allergies from an over-the-counter perspective, if the symptoms are more itchy, sneezy type symptoms, then those oral allergy meds might be more helpful. If it's really more the drippy, stuffy nasal symptoms, then the nasal sprays generally are more effective for those. Between the nasal steroid and the nasal antihistamine, the nasal antihistamine is a twice-a-day medicine. It does have the potential for some minor sedation side effect, and then it actually has a little bit of a bitter taste. So just some caveats to that one. But both the nasal steroid and the nasal antihistamine work well, and they can actually also be used together. Oh. So those are the over-the-counter options.
Good, good. Well, we'll get into prescription options next, but I want to take a call here from Marilyn, calling from Anchorage. Marilyn, welcome to Line 1.
Thank you. So I have what I call my restaurant allergy. It pretty much only happens to me in restaurants. It doesn't happen to me at home or other people's homes. But I'll be eating dinner, get near the end of dinner, and I get very stuffed up, and then I start sneezing. And I'll maybe sneeze like up to 10 times, and then it goes away. And it seems like it happens when I've had fresh vegetables or fruit. So, like, you know, if I'm having a salad or if I'm having a dessert with nice fresh fruit in it, then that happens. And I've actually had, the series of allergy tests and nothing shows up that looks like it would be causing it. But I've always just kind of wondered if it's maybe just preservatives that they're using on fruits and vegetables in restaurants.
Great question, Marilyn. Yeah, thanks for the call. Dr. Moore, any thoughts for Marilyn on her restaurant allergy?
Yeah, so based off of your symptoms, my thought would be that you're probably experiencing gustatory rhinitis. Most of the time when we go out to eat, we tend to overindulge more than we would at home, so maybe eat a little bit more. Gustatory rhinitis is actually a response where the stomach gets distended. It triggers the vagal nerve, which wraps around the stomach, and then the vagal nerve triggers nasal symptoms. So it's common. Some people will get it every time they eat. Most people, it's those larger meals like Thanksgiving dinner, Christmas dinner, you know, that triggers those symptoms. So that was kind of my first thought. I'm assuming you probably eat those nice salads both at home and at restaurants. So that's probably not the defining factor. But certainly in restaurants in the past, there have been preservatives used on particularly salad bar items. But those were removed because they were triggering asthma symptoms. So those actually aren't used in restaurants anymore. So I think the more likely answer would be that gustatory rhinitis.
That's interesting. I've never heard of gustatory rhinitis.
Yeah, it's one of the subtypes of non-allergic rhinitis. So there's lots of things that can make us sneeze, get a drippy nose, get stuffy, but they're not necessarily all allergies. So it's one of the subtypes of that process.
Okay. And then we only have a few more minutes here, so I just want to hit on any other topics that our listeners might have. But can you, Dr. Moore, just in rapid sequence here, and over about 2-3 minutes, what's the difference between or the definition of allergic rhinitis, eczema, urticaria? I know I'm asking a big question here, but like just to get those off the list so people can hear, and if like what would bring you to a doctor with those?
Allergic rhinitis is what we've spent the last hour talking about. So those are those hay fever symptoms. So I think a lot of people refer to hay fever more as the pollen allergies or the seasonal allergies, but really it's a subtype of allergic rhinitis, which is that overall category of having airborne allergies, be it to pets, pollens, dust mites, you know, whatever. Eczema is more of a skin condition, and sometimes I've heard in the past people refer to eczema as allergies of the skin. It generally is a dry, red, itchy rash. The distribution of it varies based off of the age. So in the infants, we tend to see it all over, especially on the torso and the face. And then as they get older, it progresses more into being in the folds. So the folds of the arm, the folds of the legs, the wrist behind the ears. Eczema generally is more severe in young children. It tends to get better, even go away with age. And then urticaria is a fancy word for hives. And hives can either be an acute process or a chronic process. Acute hives are often caused by foods, by medications, by insect stings, and most often by infections. So if you have a hive within an hour or two of eating a new food or of getting a bee sting or of taking a medication, that's an acute urticaria that probably would be worth being evaluated by an allergist for. If you just randomly break out in hives and they last for a couple weeks and then go away, that's most likely viral. So oftentimes there's not a lot we'll do other than take a good history. Chronic hives is a different process. Those go on for 6 weeks or longer. Those are not caused by foods, by laundry detergents, which I think are the two most common things that people like to attribute them to. They're more often actually an intrinsic process. So something going on with the body. So is it a physiologic stress? Is it thyroid disease? Is it a new onset autoimmune disease? Some of these are physical, so you get them from heat or cold or stress or pressure. But they're treated a little bit more aggressively because they can be persistent. So 90% of the time, they can last actually up to 5 to 7 years. And then we have patients that have had chronic recurring hives for 20 years or more. So, so definitely people that have chronic hives should see an allergist. And we actually have a new fast track program that helps those patients get in faster, just because that disease process can be just irritating.
No, absolutely. Itching all the time. No, thank you. We have about 1 minute left. I want to give you, Dr. Moore, the opportunity to let patients know if they want to be seen or tested, or how do they look you up? How do they get a hold of you guys?
Absolutely. We're a referral practice, so certainly you can have your primary care send a referral to us. We also have a website that you can look at. We have lots of educational opportunities on the website. That's allergyalaska.com. But yeah, we'd be happy to see anyone who's interested. There aren't a lot of us in the state anymore. So we do have a little bit of a wait list, but we're working through that as fast as we can.
Yep, I hear you. We're all in short supply these days.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, excellent. I want to thank you guys both for being part of the show today. I learned a ton just listening to you. I know our listeners did as well. Special thanks to you guys. Thank you to our audio engineer, Chris Hyde, and our producer, Madeline Rose. You can find more information on this and previous programs on our website at alaskapublic.org. Let us know your thoughts or suggestions by emailing us at line1@alaskapublic.org. This has been Line One, Your Health Connection. I'm your host, Dr. Justin Clark. Stay healthy, Alaska.
Line One is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants, and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters. Learn more about Line One and listen online at alaskapublic.org. This is Alaska Public Media.